Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and also founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that helps people with cancer understand and access the many benefits of integrative care. This show is one of the many ways that we do this, introducing you to leading experts and current thinking around optimising cancer treatment. My guest today probably wouldn't count himself as a leading expert, except when it comes to his own condition possibly, as he's a cancer patient himself, predicted to live less than a year, but committed to seeing what he can do about that. Along the way, Dale Atkinson has been causing a bit of a stir on the internet by posting about his discoveries and his thoughts as to the limitations of current cancer care. Hi Dale, absolute pleasure to have you on the show as my guest today.
Hi Robin, how are you, sir?
Well, a little bit limp after walking across Spain, but otherwise good.
I really don't blame you, but congratulations and very well done, sir. That's an absolutely fantastic achievement.
Thank you. So, people with cancer who stumble across the incredible wealth of resources that can improve their quality and indeed the length of their life, that go under the banner of integrative medicine, are naturally pretty flabbergasted they've not been told about any of this stuff by their oncologist. But some people decide that things really have got to change and become highly vocal about the need for improvement in cancer care, even using the intimate details of their own treatment as a means to raise awareness. So you fall firmly into this category, having gone majorly public about your story. So what turned you from a patient into an activist?
To be honest with you, I don't actually class myself as an activist so much. So where to start on this? I think the easiest place to start is that when I was diagnosed, I put up a post on LinkedIn, mainly because I had a lot of people, a lot of colleagues reaching out and asking me how things were going, what was up, you know, why I disappeared off of social media for a little while, etc. So initially, it was just a case of putting out an update to tell people what was actually happening and why I'd sort of disappeared off the face of planet Earth. And from that, I think I got somewhere around 10 to 12,000 messages in the end.
Wow.
Just from the one post on Facebook.
Amazing.
And half of those were messages of support and people giving me their sort of well wishes and condolences and all this kind of thing. And the other half were people asking me, I'm in a similar position. I feel completely hopeless. Is there anything you can give me? Because you seem to be upbeat about this. And I didn't think I particularly was at that point in time. But
okay.
But people read my message and thought I was very upbeat and thought I was, you know, somebody who had a way of trying to treat and deal with this sort of thing. And they were reaching out for connection and reaching out to ask for help. At that point in time, I'll be very honest, I did not enjoy, and I still don't to some extent, enjoy posting my life on social media. You will notice I never put up pictures of my kids. I will always block out their faces, etc. It's not something that's come particularly naturally to me. The activism side also isn't something that's come particularly naturally to me. However, I've realized that having tried to find somebody with a similar voice to my own, who had an early onset cancer, who's been given a terminal diagnosis, and who's tried to use sort of the complementary adjunct therapy route in order to support the standard of care route. The closest I got was our friend Jane McClelland and her book, How to Starve Your Cancer. But otherwise, there were very, very few people out there talking about this sort of stuff. There were very few people out there giving their honest and raw experience of this stuff. And there were very few people open and willing to discuss how to combine the standard of care, what was standard care, with adjunct therapies. So having seen that huge gap, I realized that it was one of those situations where I could either step up to the plate and offer my experience. And as somebody who's come from a very successful life in business, I felt it was sort of a necessity as a, you know, as a business leader who's run teams of many, many hundreds of people. I felt that having to have that voice and have that sort of authenticity and have that ability to sort of purvey my story in the way I have was a very important thing to have out there. So I took hold of it and decided to. And well, there's no going back now.
I don't think there is. Interesting story. So you sort of fell into it in a way, but then realized that actually it was a job needed doing. So yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
So look, you alluded a little bit to where you were, where your life was heading before cancer came along and irrevocably changed your plans forever. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your life before diagnosis?
Yeah, so I'd spent nearly 15 plus years working in finance. I'd become quite successful in what I did for a living. I was a consultant and contractor at a sort of global head or a senior director kind of level for various different firms. I've worked for everyone from HSBC, where I was the head of compliance for their alternatives pieces, through to Deutsche Bank, where I went on to do a project around some FCA issues they were having, so financial conduct authority issues they were having, through to working for the likes of Schroders and Wellington Management and various other firms. I had just hit the point, having been made basically redundant about a year beforehand, I decided to go off and set up my own firm. And as part of that, I'd taken on contracts for things like investigating a corrupt president for a, it's a first world, second world type nation. Can't obviously disclose who, etc. But I was investigating presidents. I was about to take on a huge contract working for a retail bank who were having some issues. And life was going fantastically, to be honest with you. You know, the only thing in the background was that in the middle of that summer, so last year, this is only 2024, my partner had a funny turn. They thought she'd had a heart attack. And they ended up rushing her into hospital and doing some tests, etc. And they unfortunately found that she had a small cell lung cancer. At that point in time, it was only a stage of 1B-ish. It was under 2 centimeters. And they were able to very thankfully and quite quickly take her into St. Thomas's in London and do a full lobectomy. So she had the entire upper right lobe of her lung removed. Huh. And that was on the 3rd of October last year, 2024.
Wow.
And then, with everything with my business panning out, I was due to sign this retail contract on the 17th of October that year. And unfortunately went in for my advice. Unfortunately, very fortunately, it turns out, went in to have an endoscopy, which had been delayed for a long, long time due to various different reasons. But I went in to have the endoscopy on my second little boy's birthday on the 15th of October. It's already at that point extremely large, aggressive, calcified, etc. And because I hadn't been able to go under the anaesthetic because my partner was just out of hospital herself, and therefore I had to drive myself there and back, I was obviously witness to it all on the screen. And it was one of those where the doctor turned around at the end and said, look, I'm so sorry, this isn't normally my job. Normally this is down to, you know, gets passed through to an MDT team and then onto an oncologist. But I have to tell you, I'm sorry, it looks like a particularly malignant cancer.
Mm.
It's looks nasty.
Right.
So went home, decided to cut off the contract because I was at a stage then where I couldn't really concentrate on anything else. We had my partner who wasn't even able to pick up the kids due to her operation. We had a 70 plus kilo Great Dane puppy who needed looking after. At that point in time, we had my in-laws over for a couple of days, well, over for a few weeks in order to help us with the kids as well, around my last operation. And we had a house full of people, and I came home, broke down completely, opened a bottle of wine and decided that was it. I was cancelling my contract. I was cancelling everything I had going on and just trying to get through and to focus on what was happening with this.
Mm. Wow, what a crash, eh? So you presumably had some sort of persistent symptoms that were irritating you for a while.
Yeah.
It was prompted the endoscopy.
Yeah, so I moved to the UK from the Channel Islands pretty much from about 6 months after I moved over. So late 2017, early 2018, I'd started having perpetual heartburn. I was carrying around, you know, a packet of Rene's. I was going through a packet a day probably. Started going to my GP in early 2018 and asking about it. Was told categorically multiple times that it wasn't really an issue. It was probably just, you know, too much acid in my stomach. It was a bad diet. It was stressful living. It was my lifestyle. It was all these other things. At no point did anyone think to escalate it particularly. I think the most I had done was some stool samples and some bloods taken. And I think they repeated that 2 or 3 times. And I got to the point where in about 2019, just before COVID, I'd been to the doctor about 5 or 6 times in the space of not very long, a month or two, probably 2-3 months actually in total. And the doctor sat down and essentially told me I was wasting their time.
Right.
He told me that I was on protein pump inhibitors. If they weren't helping, then, well, it was my lifestyle and I should go and sort myself out. Now, for context, I'm a vegetarian. I'm a former semi-professional rugby player. I was relatively fit at that point in time. I had just finished doing a white-collar boxing stint, so I'd been out training for boxing. I had been a smoker. I did drink, etc., partly because it was part of my lifestyle at that point in time. But the rest of my lifestyle was very health-focused. It was, you know, I slept well. I ate really well. I exercised every other day. I was kind of not the pinnacle of fitness by any means, but considering the rest of my lifestyle, how many hours I was working, I was in a reasonably good shape, and there wasn't any sort of underlying reason from my point of view why this should be happening in the way it was. Eventually, and unfortunately, it ended up progressing to the point where I was also getting sort of acid reflux in my sleep as well. So it was coming up and I would wake up in the middle of the night choking on acid. And that was during the early sort of COVID times. Mm. And then it began to progress on. And sort of very thankfully, we moved out of London. Not there's anything against London, but thankfully, in terms of what ended up happening, we ended up moving out of London just after our first child was born. And we moved out to rural Berkshire. And very thankfully, the GP here is the one who sort of picked up that actually this wasn't quite right. He led me through the same sort of process and did the bloods, etc. And when they came back as okay, he then realized that actually we needed to progress this. Unfortunately, he didn't know how serious things were until I started to get, first of all, pain shooting up all through my shoulder and my back and my neck. But we do now know it's an angina type of pain, because the tumor was actually pressing very heavily on a cluster of nerves. And it's the same cluster of nerves that go when you are pre-heart attack or when you have angina. And in addition to that, I began to struggle to swallow. At that point, unfortunately, they still hadn't clocked it was an urgent issue. So in about February 2024, he referred me. And it took up until October. It took up until September, actually, for a GI consultant to pick up my case file, to realize that I'd lost somewhere around the 20 to 30 kilograms of weight, that I was struggling to swallow, that I had pain, and that I had this ongoing thing, which in hindsight was probably Barrett's esophagus, which is a known precursor to esophageal cancer. And he put those together and very quickly got me in for an endoscopy. And he also then on top of that scheduled me in for a CT scan as well. So it all happened very quickly at that point after somebody had picked up the file and noticed the symptoms. But it took a good 5 or 6 years and probably well into the double figures of doctor's visits to actually get to a point where anybody took me seriously. So I'm really grateful of the latest piece of law that's come in, where after three sort of doctor's visits, you can then push for a third. Had I been able to do that at the time, my story may have been very different.
Yeah, well, I hope that piece of law does make a difference, because your story, of course, is horribly common. And, particularly when you see it around mothers and children, is that, having been in children's wards, I had mothers telling these terrible stories of how they were basically, they were treated in the most abusive manner, because they were just talked about as being neurotic when they knew there was something wrong with their kid, but nobody would listen, And then, of course, they're finally diagnosed way too late, You were obviously years lost there of time when you could have been treated probably very effectively and simply awful. But, this is what the UK is legendary for, is miss or late diagnosis. So I sincerely hope that law kicks in and makes a difference. So the actual diagnosis you were given, the prognosis you were given was what? And what did it feel like receiving it at the time?
Yeah, so my diagnosis was a metastatic esophageal adenocarcinoma. So I had a 9.2 centimeter main tumor in my esophagus, or the esophageal stomach juncture. And then I had metastases in my lymph node. Mm. Having gotten hold of my medical records, we believe there may have been one which was para-aortic, so attached to my aorta. And we think that was 4.6 centimeters per one of the reports we've gotten through. And we think there may have been a secondary on my on the neck of my pancreas as well. Although we can't quite work some of it out, because the joys of these medical records is they're a complete and utter mess, as you will know. So that's where we think I was. That's where it's reported I was. And in terms of prognosis, so I was given an average prognosis of roughly 11 and a half months at that point in time. Now, I should caveat that that was on the basis of no treatment, etc. Mm. And at that point in time, I was also told that if I did have treatment, and at that point it was chemo and immunotherapy, that at most it would look to extend my prognosis by maybe a month or two.
Wow. Hardly worth having, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly the conversation at the time is it worth the sacrifice of the quality of life in order just to have that little tiny bit of extension? Or, and I initially ended up declining chemotherapy and immunotherapy, on the basis of being able to spend more quality time with my children, but less overall quantity of time.
Makes sense.
I then did chemosensitivity testing and decided to change my mind. But that was where we were at that point in time.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with a skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
About the experience of receiving that prognosis.
So, fill in a little bit more background information probably first. So, I was diagnosed on the 15th. That was when I had the endoscopy. Unfortunately, roughly, 12 days later, my mother actually died. We found out on my eldest little boy's birthday, which was the day after my mother had died. So on Monday, the 28th of October last year, we had a phone call to tell us that my mother had unfortunately had a fall, during the night and had died. It was either the following day or 2 days later, I was then in to get my prognosis. Geez, that time's a bit blurry, as you can probably imagine.
I can.
That week sometime, I got my prognosis. It was one of those where I walked into the room. I was met with a surgeon called Mr. Booth, who shook my hand, sat me and my partner down. Basically, very, very quickly and abruptly told us that unfortunately my cancer was incurable, inoperable, that they believed I had probably less than a year to live. They handed me a book called Mummy Goes to Hospital. And I'm not sure how many of your audience have probably seen this book. But it's about a lady who has cancer, who goes through chemotherapy, loses her hair, and at the end of the book, it almost appears that she dies as well. It's really not a particularly pleasant book. It's not something I can understand why they give children at all. It is truly horrendous. And we were handed this book and basically then ushered out of the room. It was one of those where Anna didn't even have a chance to finish shedding her first tear before we were very sort of quickly ushered out.
Wow.
There was no pleasantries. There was no asking how we were. There was no asking if we needed any support. That was it. It was a handshake, a sorry for your luck, goodbye.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, not an uncommon story by any means, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah, they didn't really know how to deal with that stuff, it seems. So off you go with this horrendous outlook, obviously in the midst of a crisis time anyway, even without that. And somehow you got yourself from the position which most people would have of just seeing this big black hole ahead of them, nothing much, everything falling to bits, to getting the notion that you could actually do something about it yourself. Now, that's a big jump. What was it came along that made the difference?
So to be honest with you, there wasn't any one thing for me, and in the adverse to probably what I should say, the stage four, the terminal diagnosis, was actually a little bit of a blessing. It gave me essentially the permission to go off and to rebut against the standard of care, to not just take the answer I was given, and to look at alternative routes. Now, for me, with a mother who'd spent her entire career in the NHS, who worked as a palliative care nurse, whose entire life had been focused around doctors and listening to doctors, I had that sort of inbuilt into me and had originally, before we got the diagnosis, got in thinking, I will do exactly what the doctor says. I will listen to everything they do. I will do it to a T, and I will make sure that that gives me the best chances of survival. Having then been treated the way I was and having been given the news in the way I was, no care or support at all, I felt sort of as though I'd been done wrong by the doctors at that point in time. I felt as though this wasn't the system I expected it to be. This wasn't the care or attention that I expected from the NHS. And this was very much against how I thought things should be. So that then pushed me in my sort of rebellious side to go, and excuse my language, but fuck you. And to then use that feeling and that thought. Now, very quickly, I came across the same things that we all do, you know, the Facebook stories and Instagram stuff about, you know, coffee enemas and soursop and all these things that people are claiming are cures for cancer. And given my background in compliance, I then didn't just take those as answers, as some people do. I had to work out, first of all, why. Second of all, if they actually worked and what the evidence was. And I had to understand the mechanisms before I was willing to put my body through anything that anyone suggested. And as part of that, I realized that a lot of things that people suggest aren't real, aren't true, don't actually do what they think they do or in the way they think they do. And second of all, that there is even more out there than people think there is. That there are very weird and wonderful things that work on mechanisms that people don't talk about. There are things out there that are known and have actual, proper, real evidence and proof out there that can sort of intrinsically help people in a cancer situation. There are so many other ways and other methodologies and modalities out there that are accessible, that are there, that are evidence-backed, that are trial-backed, and are available to people. It's just we don't talk about them because they aren't included in the standard treatments. And I very quickly cottoned on that there was this whole world behind the world I saw, and I started throwing myself down rabbit holes. I looked at everything from methylene blue through to bitter gourd and soursop and all sorts of things. And I started very much at that surface level of, you know, what did Joe Bloggs on Instagram or whichever platform it is say? And I started to pick those apart. I started to realize that there was some science, although most of these people have it wrong, there was some science to things like the dog dewormers. Not that I would suggest or recommend anybody take those in a dog, canine or horse or equine format in any way, shape or form, but that there was actually some science that backed why these antiparasitics, which pathways they worked on and how exactly they worked and what their context in a cancer oncological setting is. And I began to piece together very roughly at that point in time what I thought was a, first of all, a supportive and second of all, a hopefully life-extending plan. At that point in time, I had no thoughts of curing. I had no thoughts of regression. I had no thoughts of anything else except for surviving longer for my two little boys. That's where it all sort of started.
Mm. And where and how did you first begin to connect with others looking outside the box, either other professionals or other people in your position?
So people in my position, I didn't so much connect with until slightly later. The professionals came about on LinkedIn, had so much, you know, it went so far. I think it ended up with over 1 million views at one point, and it went crazy.
Mm.
And I had some amazing people reach out to me. I had doctors from all over the world, and then I had the likes of Martin Gillespie as well. He's a metabolic practitioner based up in Scotland. So Martin reached out to me and said, look, can't promise I can help you, but let's have a chat. Let me see what I can do. Let me, you know, fit you in. You're a friend of a friend kind of thing. You popped up on LinkedIn. Let's just have a chat and see where it goes. So probably a week or two into my journey, and this was around the time my mother died, I think it was the same week, I had a call with Martin. We very quickly sort of worked out that Martin is a fantastic practitioner, but maybe he wasn't the exact practitioner I needed on the basis that I'm vegetarian and a few other things, and he focuses a little bit more on the carnivore style diet. And he then put me onto Amanda King. Amanda King is a naturopath and a nutritionist who is just been incredible. She's one of my favorite human beings on earth, not just as part of this journey, just in general now. She is so incredibly knowledgeable and switched on about everything. And she is the ultimate teacher I have met on this journey. She's just beyond amazing. And I ended up connecting with her. She ended up sitting me down, and she was the first person in this world I trusted wholeheartedly for some strange reason. In addition to that, I'd also connected with Dr. Thomas Seyfried over in the US, who focuses a lot on glioblastomas and brain cancers. I had ended up watching his Diary of a CEO episode with Stephen Bartlett, contacted him, and he also then put me in touch with a researcher based at the University of Westminster called Dr. Isabella Cooper, who focuses on metabolic health as well. And she at that point had also jumped in and helped to, first of all, to teach me, and second of all, to help me design those first few steps past sort of what people on Instagram, et cetera, said, and into real science. And between the two of them, I ended up piecing together little bits and pieces all over the place that sort of started to not necessarily work, and nothing works that sort of quickly, but little bits and pieces that I felt, first of all, I had control over, which then made me feel better because I was in control of my situation and not leaving it down to somebody else to dictate to me. And second of all, I started to understand what the mechanisms at play were, and therefore how to deal with and how to attack those on a daily basis. Be that through things like introducing berberine into my diet. So using berberine as a supplement in order to lower blood glucose, because it was likely my tumor was glycolytic in nature, I used sugar to feed itself. So I then used a keto-focused diet, a vegetarian keto diet, and twinned that with things like berberine in order to then lower the glucose levels in my body and begin to attack some of these tumors. And with that, I started to quite quickly feel, maybe just mentally and psychosomatically, but slightly better. It gave me a starting point to fight from, and it gave me something that I felt, it gave me the tools I felt I could fight with. And that really was the starting point to all of this. It was the empowerment given to me by Dr. Cooper and by Amanda King.
Fantastic, yeah. It's great to have a really good professional who gives you the time so as you understand what you're doing, why you're doing it. You can get completely behind a treatment then.
I think that's a very important point as well, is in terms of the professional you pick. So I spoke to probably 15, 20, I've spoken to way above into the 50 plus naturopaths, et cetera, now, and nutritionists. I've spoken to tens of integrative oncologists all over the world. The one thing I would sort of instill in terms of a team is it doesn't matter the stance somebody has directly. What really should matter to a patient is not what somebody else did, not who helped somebody else. I wouldn't suggest directly that Amanda King is the right person for everybody. What I would suggest is that anybody in a similar position to mine, anybody who wants to follow this sort of a track, needs to find the right person for them. That trust in somebody, that ability to communicate with them, and that ability to actually give yourself to them and do what they are asking of you, matters 10 times more than I think the individual protocol does in a lot of cases. It's that ability to trust in the direction you're going and trust that this person is caring for you in the right way possible, gives you the mental fortitude and gives you the strength to be able to continue far more than believing in the individual protocol itself.
Fantastic point, and very clearly put.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? check out Health Triangle magazine on the ukhealthradio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Great. One thing out of interest. What, in your opinion, which of the skills you gained in your earlier life have been the most invaluable to you in this journey?
So I think that's a really good question. So from my compliance background, I was used to dealing with extremely large volumes of information. I would see spreadsheets with, you know, a million plus lines on it. I would go through transaction monitoring systems where we're looking for fraudulent payments. I would go through, you know, huge, huge data sets. And I would go through regulations, which are hundreds of pages long, written in a language that is purposely complex. And the two of those skills together gave me sort of the perfect mix of tools, as it were, in order to approach this. Because first of all, I could dissect and ingest huge volumes of information. And I should point out at this point, between diagnosis and probably January time, I read somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 research papers. And on top of that, I read everything from Kelly Turner's Radical Remission through to, I read Dr. Thomas Seyfried's book on metabolic cancers. I read, obviously, Jane McClellan's book, How to Starve Your Cancer, and a number of others as well. I was very lucky in terms of the skill set I had and my ability to read at that sort of level and ingest that information. And I was very lucky and fortunate as well that my partner, who was still recovering from her own lung cancer journey, was able to pick up some of the slack and give me the space and time to do so as well. And that all together is what then gave me the ability to formulate my own plan.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, look, I just want to tease out one thing, give you a chance to talk about it a little bit. I mean, you quite often make the point, I think, that, look, this is what I did, but don't just do what I did. You do try and pass on a kind of construct for the means of finding out what to do, how you develop your own plan, and encourage other people to pick that up. Do you want to give a quick rundown on that distinction between just follow my leader with the actual treatments and approaches, or find
out? Yeah, absolutely, of course. So for me, one of the big sort of turning points and one of the big changes in my journey compared to a lot who came before me was the advent of things like next generation sequencing. So instead of running a blind plan based on my tumor, so looking at it as an adenocarcinoma, it has certain sort of characteristics. Instead of looking at the characteristics and focusing on the characteristics, as you would do through things like Jane McClellan's MetroMap, I took it one level further and went and got next generation sequencing done through a company called Astron Health. And what that essentially did was break down the genetic markers of my tumor and of my body in general as well to look for any deficiencies, issues, problems, overexpressions, underexpressions, etc. And it then ran it via something called the Data Exacta test. They then ran it against, first of all, chemo. So looking at the different types of chemo and standard treatments that were available and how effective they would be. And then second of all, they looked at both supplements and off-label drugs. So we were able to identify a number of underused and not very often utilized drugs and methodologies and modalities that would actually affect my tumor that may not have been part of a standard sort of plan. So for me, that was one of the most important parts of my journey, was having the scientific proof of exactly what my tumor was doing and then exactly how to fight it. Now, in my instance, that happened to be particularly meaningful because mine was a differentiated tumor. And it's since turned out that it has a lot of the hallmarks of a squamous cell, however you want to pronounce it, as opposed to an adenocarcinoma. And therefore, some of the attack pathways that you would have naturally picked up for an adenocarcinoma may not have worked in my instance. So for me, having that scientific backing, having the proof, having the report that came through that showed me, first of all, the percentage of cell death and exactly what would work and which drugs to look at and why. But it also then broke it down into a further subsect and provided me with, first of all, the direct papers that they were citing to show why these happened. which then allowed me to do my own research and to find other ways that were outside of their remit to look at. And that it also allowed me to then take that plan to a brilliant integrative oncologist called Dr. Harry Kuhn, who then helped me. And together we created a protocol around all of the things that were in that plan. Now, a lot of the drugs that we ended up picking and using aren't necessarily those that are used in all paths, but they were the ones that were the right exact version for me. We were able to better understand what level, what quantity I needed because of the mapping as well. And we were able to better understand the interactions and which combination of those drugs.
Amazing. So, and in terms of monitoring your progress, you know, an extraordinarily important part of the whole thing, to know that you're heading in the right direction, things are working. How did you do that?
So we did it a couple of different ways. First of all, is I actually kept my own sort of diaries. So I kept logs of what I was taking. I layered things in. Because of the timeline of things, I did throw a lot of it all at once. So we weren't able to map exactly which things made the biggest difference.
No.
And I've never been able to say that one singular thing made my path any different, because I don't think any one thing did anyway. But I did that. I logged everything. We also tracked through Amanda my bloods every single month. So we do a full blood panel every single month. We track everything from my vitamin levels through to, you know, CRP. So looking at things like my inflammation levels in my body. And we adapt and update every single month on that basis. Atop that, I also had 3 monthly scans through the NHS, of course, looking at, you know, what the size of my tumor was, etc. And then luckily for me, I say luckily, not really, but sort of luckily, because of the location of my tumor and sort of the side effects that came with it, because it was blocking my esophagus, I could physically feel the difference. You know, after a couple of months, so it hit probably February, March time last year, I could feel the physical difference with my swallowing. I could get food through. I wasn't having to lie on the floor for an hour after every meal in writhing, agonizing pain. I was able to drop opioids and other drugs they had put me on, and I was able to actually physically feel the difference. Now, unfortunately, that's not the case for a lot of people's cancers and a lot of tumors.
No.
But for me, I was able to feel that, and therefore it gave me more motivation to keep going.
Okay. So look, not much time left. I know that you, like me, would like to see cancer care get a lot better, and we know it could be a lot better. So what are the straightforward changes that you feel our NHS could make right now, which would be cost effective and would improve cancer care radically?
So first of all, I feel this is probably the right juncture to mention that myself and Joe McClelland are actually setting up a charity as well called Beyond the Standard.
Yes.
Very similar to yourself, we are looking to try and help people on their cancer pathways. I think the one sort of small difference is we are looking to create materials and to create educational pieces, both for doctors and for patients, to help them to better understand how this pathway actually works in reality. And with that, we want to then begin lobbying the government in order to make some of those changes. In terms of what the NHS can do now, so very thankfully, the 10-year plan does include some of the things that I think are necessary. So the NHS 10-year plan includes things like next-generation sequencing. It also includes things like chemosensitivity testing, potentially, although it's very much in grey in there. The second thing I'd very much like to see, which is part of what myself and Jane are going to be lobbying for, is the use of off-label and out-of-patent drugs for modalities and sort of for settings in which there is safety data, in settings in which they are already phase 3 trial approved. And when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about things like the use of metformin in oncology. So metformin on its own has been shown as a singular additive and as a singular complementary treatment to normal oncological practices. It has been shown to increase survival rates by somewhere around 30 to 40%, very roughly. And that's no small amount. And that's a drug which costs pennies. It has safety data coming out of your ears because it's been used in diabetes for many years. And it's a drug that the NHS already prescribes left, right, and centre and has no issue in doing so. So why the NHS can't adapt a pathway in order to add that into an oncological setting, given the safety data, given the fact that there is trial data around the use in an oncological setting, and the fact that it is so cheap and therefore adds very little to the NHS's burden, I'd like to see things like that bought in and trialed, at least trialed at a local level, and then hopefully rolled out nationally if it is shown to make the difference that the trials indicate it should. I'd also like to see more accountability, and I'd also like to see a phased introduction of personalized care, because at this moment in time, as it stands, there is very few, very little boxes that people are stacked into. There is no accounting for the huge current rise in things like early onset cancers, as mine was, which is those of a younger age picking up cancers that were historically for those of an older generation. And for those suffering who've been diagnosed at a more advanced level than they naturally should have been, which is also my case. I'd like to see more personalized care and more ability to see outside of and think outside of the standard box for people who are within that category, at least at first, to then see how that goes and then to filter that down into the wider cancer category in total.
So this is using INHS to develop real world data of helping people in these constructive ways, which is absolutely what it should be doing as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know what the real aim of it was.
You can't rely on anybody else to go testing metformin, basically, because nobody wants to do it. It's only for the benefit of patients. It's not really going to make anybody any money. So that's why it has to be done by the NHS.
While data, et cetera, already exists. Right. So the only thing stopping it at this moment in time is the sort of slow-moving nature of the NHS in general.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there is a bit more than that. We had the incident back in 2014 or when it was filibustered in Parliament. You know, they made quite sure that a repurposed medications bill didn't go through because, of course, it goes against the interests of business, unfortunately.
Sorry.
Yeah, so look, one last very important question. How's it going? How do things look now?
So that's a very good question. I actually had the results of my latest scan on Thursday last week. Things are looking great. I'm not quite NED yet. There is unfortunately still a very small amount of residual metabolic activity, but it is very, very localized. So on my scan before this, I had some remaining sort of thickening of the distal esophageal wall, and there's just a little bit of metabolic activity around that. So fingers crossed.
Going the right way. That's amazing. Yeah, NED, for anybody who doesn't know, no evidence of disease. This is the kind of the holy grail you're heading for. Yeah, well, amazing. I mean, when you consider where you started out, that's an extraordinary achievement. And this has included some standard care in as much as you had chemotherapy, but specific chemotherapy had been, which you knew was going to help. But then a whole array of other approaches as well, which are, you know, in the main, they're safe. So an extraordinary achievement, and you know, huge credit to you for picking up the reins and driving forward your own care, basically, in the way that you have. So, great. We're going to have to leave it there. Great pleasure to have you on the show, Dale. You're making a lot of waves with your self-advocacy, which isn't really, and your great communication skills, of course, which people enjoy very much, and it is a big draw. So I wish you every success in your own treatment, of course, and in bringing change to UK cancer care.
Thank you, Robin. That's very much appreciated.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Be in touch. Robin. Have a good day. Bye.
Do look out for Dale's posts on LinkedIn. He's also on Facebook, but I think LinkedIn seems to be his main platform. His posts are always a great read as they're thoughtful, thought-provoking, and as I mentioned earlier, he's simply a great writer. Thanks very much for listening today. I do hope you'll want to connect in again next week for the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.